Sunset Lake CBD is a majority employee-owned hemp farm located right outside of Burlington, Vermont. Before they started growing hemp, Sunset Lake Farms produced cream for Ben & Jerry's. Sunset Lake CBD doesn't use any pesticides or herbicides to grow any of its hemp plants, and they use organic fertilizer and other sustainable farming techniques to ensure the long-term health of the soil and to minimize their carbon footprint. So like all of us, my days are really stressful. By the end of the night, my kids are in bed, I'm taking a minute to chill, but I'm still unwinding. I recently started using the Relax Gummies infused with CBD isolate, reishi mushroom extract, and ashwagandha root extract. I'm really glad I tried these because they really helped me get ready for a good night of sleep, and I really think I sleep better, so I'd highly recommend it. So check out Sunset Lake CBD today at sunsetlakecbd.com and use the code HFPOD for 20% off your order. That's sunsetlakecbd.com and use the code HFPOD for 20% off your order. Farmer owned, Vermont grown, Sunset Lake CBD.
At Grand Canyon University, we believe in equal opportunity, and the American dream starts with purpose. Whether your pursuit involves a bachelor's, master's, or doctoral degree, GCU's learning environments are designed for supportive networking and collaboration. With over 330 academic programs, GCU provides a path to help you fulfill your dreams. The pursuit to serve others is yours. Find your purpose at GCU. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu.
Hey listeners, I want to tell you about a sponsor, Music Masters Collective. They're a nonprofit organization that produces unique music events, providing opportunities for fans and artists to meet and collaborate in an inspired and creative atmosphere. Every week, they host different events, all with the opportunity to learn from world-class musicians like Oteil Burbridge, Trouble No More, former members of The Band, Milk Carton Kids, Nikki Glaspie, Bill Frisell, Sean Colvin, and many more. This June, join the Fab Four, Joan Osborne, John Sebastian, Marshall Crenshaw, and a great group of faculty for the debut of Magical Mystery Camp. This all-inclusive, once-in-a-lifetime music vacation experience in the heart of the Catskills will be packed with nightly performances, workshops, speakers, song circles, open mics, and a lot more. If you're a performing musician at any level, bring your instrument. If you're a music lover, bring your good spirit. It's an amazing experience for individuals, friends, and couples alike. Registration is open, spots are filling up, so check it out soon. And scholarships are available. Check out magicalmysterycamp.com/helpingfriendly to learn more.
Osiris.
It's Turner
and Seth.
And we are Inside Out with Turner
and Seth.
And we're a part of the Osiris Podcast Network.
Our podcast features extended interviews that go beyond the normal sugar-coated generic interviews often associated with the jam band world.
And we also expand outside of the jam band world, doing deep dives with artists that you love. We are part of, I mentioned, the Osiris Network, and you can find us on jambase.com and, of course, at insideoutwtns.com.
Hey, everybody. This is the Helping Friendly Podcast. This is episode 153. I'm here with Jonathan.
Hello.
And Matt.
Hey there.
We are talking about the ghosts of the forest. There are a lot of them. But do you know where is Brad? Where is Brad? Brad is actually in the forest.
Oh, I think he's trying to run down some ghosts.
He's trying to find the ghosts of the forest.
He's got a jumpsuit and a proton pack.
Yeah. He got a little confused about the premise. We said that we were going to do Ghosts of the Forest this week, and he, instead of doing his homework and listening up, disappeared into the woods with a flashlight. I believe he's in the Upside Down right now, but I can neither confirm nor deny that.
So Brad is actually literally searching for the ghosts of the forest. Matt and Jonathan and I, we took the easier route, which is to go see Ghost of the Forest last weekend in DC, right? That was pretty cool, don't you think, Gus?
Hell yeah.
Yeah, I had a good time.
We'll get to that. Show.
We're gonna talk about it. Before we get to that, so the night we're recording, there have been several Ghost of the Forest shows, and we're going to talk about that, the shows, but also the album, which has, I think, been surprisingly amazing. Not surprising, maybe surprisingly
is it a surprise?
Amazing.
I don't know. I mean,
I don't know. I'm a Phish fan, man. I'm not expecting albums to be awesome. Or that's the stereotype, at least. Aren't I not supposed to?
Don't believe the press. You can like things.
Matt, can I like things?
It just depends on how jaded you are. Like, I feel like, well, I don't know. We'll get to all that. But it's good to have an opinion one way or another. Let's put it that way.
So before we get into it, so obviously there's going to be a lot of Ghost of the Forest talk. There's a trade documentary is going to be premiered at the Tribeca Film Festival on April 26th in New York with a tab show. And then there are Phish shows coming in the summer. What else is going on in the Phish world? Anything?
There's a lot. That's a lot to be going on, especially this time of year. This is usually the dead time of year, and we've gotten Ghost of the Forest and Trey solo shows and a documentary and summer coming up and hopefully something about Big Cypress this year. Speaking of which, if you've not gotten to us your submission of your story for Big Cypress, go ahead and do that. We want to try to wrap that up probably around the end of this month. So if you haven't done it, if you've been sitting around thinking that you'll get to it someday once you've perfected your story in your mind, get on it. Record yourself, ideally in a very quiet space with the best recording device that you have. It could just be the phone that's in your pocket, and tell us what Big Cypress was like for you and for your crew, and any interesting thoughts that you've had about it over the last 20 years. Send it to bigcypress@osirispod.com. You might either hear yourself on our Big Cypress retrospective that we're going to do later this year, or we may ask you to do an interview with us if we really dig your story. So keep those coming. We've gotten some really cool things so far.
Do it now. Do it now.
Do it now.
Yeah, that's a different anniversary.
I know. I know exactly what you're saying, Jonathan, and I appreciate you for doing that. I just want to say that if you think that your story is like not interesting or like no one wants to hear this, just tell us, because actually people do want to hear it. Any story from being there is important, so get those stories in.
And you know, if your story is in fact terrible, we promise not to make fun of you on the air. We'll just put it aside, you know, and you won't know if it was because it was terrible or we just had too many. We promise we'll be nice.
Okay, so that's enough for Phish news. I thought that Jonathan would tell me that, like, you know, Burlington 1979 was being released on vinyl, but it turns out
That already happened on Record Store Day about 10 hours ago.
Okay. Shit. Totally missed it. All right. So, guys, I want to just say that, as everybody knows, we're part of the Osiris Network, and Joe Kendrick did an amazing episode about the song Wagon Wheel, which I was like, I was just very satisfied listening to that episode, listening to the origins of the song and just the beautiful kind of controversy, but also the adulation that it received. I thought that was really cool, and it just reminded me that Joe's doing a really good job on Southern Songs and Stories, which is a really good podcast. You guys listened to the Wagon Wheel episode, right?
I didn't. I was afraid.
I am going to listen to it. My 4-year-old daughter is obsessed with that song right now. She has to listen to it like a few times a day, asks for it all the time. I will say that in terms of a rock nerd dad victory, I did get her to finally stop listening to the Darius Rucker version and at least listening to the old Cro-Medicine version. So she's listening to the right version. I haven't tackled that one yet, 'cause I'm kind of afraid what I'm going to learn, given the fact that this song plays in my house so much. I will say, I mean, flip side of the coin, the other song that she's obsessed with right now is Say It To Me Santos, and knows every word. So, There are multiple good parenting moves going on there.
One of the, so everyone should check out this episode of Southern Songs and Stories, but it's interesting how it evolved from like a very traditional kind of, you know, Southern blues song into actually something that became a, yeah, sorority fraternity hit. And we interviewed one of the guys, Ketch from Old Crow at Delfest, and he's a cool dude, and they've done some good work, but they like made this song. It's just, it's an interesting evolution of a song. So if you haven't heard that podcast, you should check it out. Anything else that you guys have been listening to before we move on, Jonathan?
So many things, actually, but there's a new Bruce Hornsby album that, this is not Fish related, but let me tell you guys, it's super good. It's super good.
Still making music?
Not only is he still making music, but he may have made one of his better albums and just released it.
Amazing.
I'm going to be talking about it on the Discologist podcast.
Yeah.
Very soon, actually. Might even come out this week.
Amazing.
Sweet.
Friend of the pod.
Yeah.
And Matt, what about you?
So I really dug, I kind of was a listener in terms of the fact that I was not a part of the conversation, but I did edit it and mix it and put it out into the world, which was our last episode with Harvey from Lewis Tape. And then I really enjoyed, I'd never listened to Lewis Tape before, and I listened to you on there, RJ, as part of the crossover. I'm not a Widespread Panic fan, but I was really excited to listen to both sides of that experience just to see, you know, how the gap could be bridged in terms of both sides. I really liked, I actually kind of like came into your listening experience with Widespread Panic with as open of a mind as I could. And I found that the stuff that I don't like about Widespread Panic, I still don't like about Widespread Panic. So it was pretty good validation. I thought it was a really good discussion, actually, and gave me a little bit of a different perspective, but it did nothing to change me.
Well, I felt ill-prepared, even though I'd listened to like the shows that Harvey gave me, the Widespread Panic shows that he gave me a few times. I just didn't know what to say besides like the jams were good, except when they weren't. And like when he was on HF Pod, he was much more articulate about specific songs. So I don't know. I feel the same way, but I was actually really enjoying just like the rocking. It just reminded me of the one time I saw them. That was the one time I remember that I saw them, which was just like such a rocking good time. You know, I think that's like the whole thing, is that there's like a rocking good time aspect to it, which I think is great, but it gets, I think a lot of things get mixed up in, you know, having a good time at concerts, right? Like there's a lot in there between Widespread Panic and Fish and the Dead and lots of other bands that, I don't know, sometimes you just want to go and fucking rock out and have a good time.
Yeah. Sure. That's one way of looking. No, I have nothing, not to go too far down the rabbit hole with Panic or anything like that, but, I wouldn't say I'm a hater per se. Like they're, you know, they're fine musicians and people dig them, and that, you know, I wouldn't hold that against them or anything like that. But what happened when I was listening to Blue is Tape was that like, it really reinforced why I don't like them, because every time like a clip would start up at the beginning of it, I'd be like, all right, this is kind of cool. Like it's got a good groove, and you know, it's got like a, you know, they did that. There was like one cover of, Professor Longhair or something like that, and like that was pretty cool. And then like I think the one song like Diner or something like that, I was like, you know, as soon as it came on, I was like, all right, this is kind of cool. And then like 2 minutes later, I was sick of it, and I'm like, why, just can you please just do something else other than just play this swampy groove and have Jimmy Herring like solo or Mike Hauser like solo the shit out of it. And I think I got some really good My eyes were open to something that Harvey said on our episode, which I think actually for me kind of defines the difference between Panic and Fish fans, was he kept saying like basically kind of like talking negatively about Type 2 jamming. And he kept saying like, why don't you just jam on the song? Like you have songs for a reason. Don't do this like super out there stuff. Just like jam on the song. We want to hear the song. where I think that most Phish fans would probably say the exact opposite, which is that, like, you know, get the fuck away from the song. We've heard the song before. We want to hear you do something completely spontaneously and creative and of the moment. And I think that kind of goes back to what I was saying a second ago, that, like, anytime I hear Panic Jam, I'm like, all right, this is cool. Like, it's got a shredding guitar, but, like, do something different, you know, like take the music in a new direction.
Yeah. And that might be, like, I don't know what that is. And maybe Jonathan, you have some perspective as a Grateful Dead fan, which is in my mind, like, I'm a Grateful Dead fan too, as is Matt, but, like, it sort of merges a lot of these things in terms of, like, you know, 70s rock and 80s rock and something else, but also just, like, getting out there. I think that's true. And it's interesting because now that we're talking about Ghost of the Forest, there's a lot of not getting out there, which we'll talk about. But Jonathan, what's your take on Widespread Panic? And does that, like, does what Matt said resonate with you, or do you see it differently?
I first saw Panic in 94 and I loved it. Loved it. It was great. I saw him again in 96 and it was okay. And then I saw him again in 96 and it was not okay. And I didn't go back and see them for like 10, 15 years. And then it was just fun. I had fun with my friends and the music wasn't terrible. And that's about all I need from Widespread Panic.
All right, guys, we're here to talk about Ghost of the Forest. So 20 songs live, fewer songs on the album. We're about halfway through toward the end of the concert tour of Ghost of the Forest. Jonathan and Matt, I want to hear from you guys. Like, what are you guys thinking right now about Ghost of the Forest in terms of how cool it is and, I don't know, how important it is long-term in terms of Phish, because that's what I really care about.
I think it's pretty damn cool. Trey has poured his heart into this thing, and it gives you, there's an emotional roller coaster ride, if you will, a lot of ups and downs through it, and it's powerful. And on top of that, there's some killer music, like the lots of guitar playing. The whole band is great. Phish is all over these songs. And the Solis and Jen sing beautifully. It's terrific. I'm into this whole thing. Especially love the album. Matt?
Yeah, I absolutely love it. I love every single part of it. So we should say the three of us all went to the DC show last weekend at the Anthem, and I did you guys come into it cold as well, or did you listen to the earlier shows?
Yeah, I didn't listen to any of it.
I listened just to the first song, Ghost of the Forest, that they released.
Yeah, so I listened to that, and I had the opening night in Portland, I had the fan stream like on in the background. I really was not listening intently, and I got a little bit of like the flavor of what the music was like, and I shut it off. I really wanted to experience this thing in person for the first time and just absorb it all. And I was prepared to either, you know, be lukewarm on it. I was even prepared to not like it. And I was also very prepared, regardless of what my opinion was, to hear a lot of negative opinions about it. Just because that's kind of been the nature of Trey's solo work that, you know, I mean, you see even just like the magnitude of the tours and the shows, like, you know, Phish is playing, you know, 20,000 seat venues all the time on the reg and selling them out without any difficulty. And Trey can, you know, play like a 2000 seat theater and not even sell it out. People don't always get into the Trey side project stuff. And much has been said about Trey's writing over the past, you know, 10, 13 years or so in lyrical content and people liking, not liking it. And even some of the stuff for Phish, a lot of people don't like newer Phish material. And I was blown away. I mean, it feels like something so different than anything that Trey's done. I mean, there's some musical overlap, like you can almost hear it parts where it sounds similar to, like, you know, Petrichor or Time Turns Elastic or something like that. And especially in terms of just like the composition of some of the melody lines and things like that. But I remember thinking during the show that if this entire thing is not being sort of deliberately packaged by Trey's team as an attempt to break through to the indie rock market, that they're missing out on a huge opportunity. And I kept thinking about, like, when, you know, back when, like, when Shine came out, right, and Phish had broken up, and Trey was saying in interviews, like, about this new type of music that he was writing, that he wanted to write a killer pop song because he'd done all these crazy complex compositions, and what he thought was the most difficult thing in the world was to write a killer hit pop song. And he never really kind of connected on that. He wrote a bunch of stuff that wasn't successful, and a lot of his fans didn't really like either. And here you have something that, like, I would put this album on my record shelf next to something by maybe the War on Drugs before I would ever put it next to a Phish record. I think that it's got an emotional weight. It's got a conciseness to a lot of the music. And it's got, you know, kind of, at least on the album, just a sound that is, like, so modern and so emotional, and it's dad rock, but in, like, the best possible way. And I love it. I'm floored.
Jonathan, as another avid record person, so they were able to capture something on this album, I think, that I felt like wasn't necessarily reflected in the show. And maybe you feel differently, maybe you don't, but, like, there was an intensity and a kind of emotional quality, as Matt was alluding to, that I think they captured on this album that I didn't really, like, I haven't heard in the shows. Do you feel the same way, or, and, like, how does that work?
I feel that, well, the album is sonically different. It's the tone is the same, of course, but it just sounds different, and that's to be expected. But I felt that live, the emotional weight of the thing, you know, that Trey's doing there for us was definitely present. I sat for most of the show. I had a pretty good seat and watched and listened almost the entire time, except for the one song I got up and danced over Where You Were. I did feel the emotional weight. I was emotional watching the show. It definitely carries. I think the pacing of the show is a bit different, though, as well, because there's more songs, which we should start getting into probably. It flows a bit different, has a little more breathing room, a couple more up tunes.
That's fair. But Jonathan, you avoided my question, man, because I want to keep talking about how awesome this album is. How many times in Phish history have we said that, like, this album is possibly just better than the live experience? Never, probably, except for
a live one, maybe.
When you used to say that about Junta, I remember when you were in 89, you were, like, saying that
back in the day. Yeah, yeah, when we were hanging out and listening to that tape back in 1977.
I don't know. It's amazing. It's amazing that we're even having the conversation, I guess.
It's good. By the way, I don't think I agree with you on the album being better than the live experience. I thought, as great as the album is, and I've been listening to it really on repeat since it was released to streaming. But before that, I had been listening to the live show a lot throughout the week before, you know, in the week between. I still think the live show was better. It was more energetic. I think the extra material, while the best material was probably on the album, the extra material really helped. And there really were some great pieces. The other thing that you can't discount is the visual experience of this show. Once again, so different, deliberately different than Phish. It's not Chris Kuroda lighting. It's different lighting. It's video components, which, once again, they tried. I mean, they literally tried some of these exact visual stuff. Like, I would imagine that, like, the LED panels that they were using were, like, sitting in a warehouse somewhere since 2016. And they were like, hey, let's try these out again. Abigail Holmes, who did all this visual stuff, I saw her, you know, at the show, and she was like running the light board and the video and everything all night. It was like a total badass. And there was a couple of things that they did visually. I'll mention them as I remember them as we talk about the material, that were just, like, stunning. It really, really brought the whole thing to a head. I also dug, like, the experience of kind of receiving so much super, super emotional material in a crowd of people. There was a lot of, you know, there were a lot of like misty eyes, and there were a lot of, I was standing, with you, RJ, for a good chunk of the show, and we were with Drew Hitz, friend of the pod, who many of you know from Twitter and from the Mockingbird Foundation. And he had just experienced a loss in his life. Everybody's dealt with death at some point. And so I think a lot of the lyrical content, that people were hearing for the first time, just like, it's kind of like they say, you know, you laugh harder at a comedy movie when you see it in a theater than you do watching it by yourself. It was like the kind of the opposite right. of that, like receiving this really weighty emotional material was that much more intense surrounded by people that were having the same experience as you. And I think if you're listening to this and you, have a chance to go to one of the last remaining shows out on the West Coast, you absolutely should do it. Even if you've heard the material, even if you watched one of the New York webcasts, go see it and experience it in person, because it was pretty amazing.
You know, I'm going to have to second you there, Matt, that RJ is definitely wrong.
Thank you. If you're going to Berkeley, just look for me at the Greek Theater. I'd love to give you a high five. So, Jonathan, you're not going to agree with Matt on this. I'm not going to let you do that. I mean, you already did, but I'm going to now change the topic.
You're going to write it down differently?
Yes. Okay. So let's talk about some of the songs. So the shows start with a piano intro where nobody is on stage. I think all of them start the same, right?
And
I don't know why Ray isn't like playing the piano on stage. I'm confused about that, but maybe you guys know.
It's a little like a kind of like an overture, although it's not really drawing reference to the rest of the pieces. It's just the moment before the players take the stage.
Yeah. A lot of times something like that I find serves as kind of a get your asses in your seats cue, especially with, they may have been concerned about Fish fans who are just, you know, wandering around doing whatever the hell, but getting beers and stuff like that. And they wanted to have an attentive audience. They did. They like turned the house lights down to 50% at that point. And then like at the end of that piano intro, they turned them completely off, and
right.
they had the audience there, you know, kind of raptured. I mean, once
I
again,
running back with my coffee, I got my coffee with plenty of time.
This is something that non Fish bands would do. Bands that go out and they do a show, you know, U2, Pink Floyd. These bands would do things like this to sort of set the stage for their big entrance in the start of the show.
This is, I guess, so starting to talk about the title track, Ghost of the Forest. This is, to me, and I don't know if you guys agree or not, but there's like this thematic. Obviously, the entire thing is thematic, but I feel like Ghost of the Forest, this song kind of sets the tone for the entire rest of the show, and it's like a little bit more overarching, and some of the other songs are a little bit more specific. It just feels like a scene setting of like kind of an overarching sense of like what Trey is trying to communicate about, you know, just drowning in all these different things, and then the rest of the songs kind of go into depth on those things. Did you feel like that? Like, do you feel like it's like a kind of telling you what you're going to hear throughout the rest of the show, or is that a different read?
I think it kind of does that. It also invites you in, you know, it says get in, get out. So it's immediately pointing to thresholds and transitions and bringing you right in. And then of course we'll hear those at the very end of the album as well.
Yeah.
Almost here, my pulse.
for Fish or Trey, this is like completely foreign, you know, which is what makes it so admirable and interesting. It's not like Trey is like has done this before in terms of like the, I don't know, just more of a production, or this is what a play would be like, right? I mean, he's done music for plays and done a lot of that sort of stuff, but do you know what I'm saying? It's a totally different mission.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's his second rock opera, right? I mean, you mm-hmm. know, The Man Who Stepped yeah. Into Yesterday was the first one. They have done a few stagings of that earlier on. And this is a new thing, and you can't like I love that, having heard it now and heard all this material, like I love that it's, they just didn't have these songs that they like threw into a random set list every night and mix them in with tab tunes and stuff like that. Like I really appreciate the fact that this is a piece of music that's gone out and been performed every night.
Yeah. I agree with that. And I really want to add that when they dropped this song, this first song, I probably listened to it 20, 30 times in the next day or two. Just constantly playing it over and over at my desk and on the train and stuff. I really like this song.
What at which number of the playing of it did you get it?
I was there. I was at least partially there from the beginning.
Okay. So like number 30 was just like a reinforcement.
Number 30 is just where I got just pulled into something else and didn't get to number 31.
So I don't know if you guys had a similar experience, but when I was listening back, I had a hard time like differentiating between some of the songs, like where Ghost of the Forest End and Drift While You're Sleeping started. That might have just been me, but it did. There's a lot of overlap and kind of smooth segues between the songs.
Yeah, particularly in the live show. It was very tight, and some of these things have like multiple movements to them and mm-hmm. things like that. So I agree with you. It was difficult to tell some of that stuff, especially, you know, with the live show, you know, once again, complete opposite of Fish. When you've got a set show that you're going to do, I mean, there's a matter of 5 seconds between every song. I mean, they were just boom, 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 one into the next. So it's easy to lose your place.
Well, and also not having heard any of it when yeah. we first saw it. So I was like, this set of lyrics sounds very different from that set of lyrics, but that's not a guarantee that it's a different song. Just because, particularly here on Drift While You're Sleeping, that song changes a few times. It's got the reggae section in the middle, and yeah, great tune though. This is one of my favorites.
There does seem to be a little bit of like a composition at the beginning and then the reggae breakdown. There's mm-hmm. like several different parts that I still can't really follow.
Yeah, this is where, like, kind of like when I mentioned before, like, you'd hear, like, a little bit of a relationship back to, like, a Petrichor or mm-hmm. Time Turns Elastic, some of those composed things. You da 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 da. That kind of stuff that's thrown in. But you also have, like, you know, the part at the beginning is really cool. The reggae section in the middle is really cool. And then the hugely, like, anthemic, you know, it's like they drop you right into the peak of like a Fish Bliss jam, like, and you've got like the powerful voices singing all around and everything like that. The one thing that it's interesting to me, I mean, like, given like the context and the obvious emotional weight to the whole thing, like, it's interesting that lyrics in this, like, you know, it's love, it's always was and will be love. You know, people, like, you could put that right next to, you know, And the Light Shines On or Set Your mm-hmm. Soul Free or something like that. And in terms of looking at it as just like maybe a little cheesy or something like that. But within this context, it hooks you and like, you're like, hell yeah. Like,
yeah,
I really agree with this. I don't know. It's very weird. I'm having a hard time. Like, I've been thinking about this a lot for the last week, like trying to contextualize, like, why I like this so much. And I like a lot of other of my favorite albums of the past couple of years that I kind of get obsessed with. Like, it's hard to describe it other than there's so much to unpack that it just invites repeat listens and shows you a little something different every time.
Yeah. I think some of that has to do with the fact that, like, you know, Trey's friend Chris, who this was written about and for and around, really loved, like, when Trey just raged guitar like a rock star, you know? Yeah. Like, a lot of these songs are like, have a serious classic rock vibe to me that a lot of Trey's other, like, you know, solo songwriting stuff just doesn't. I don't know if that's part of it, but that's part of it for me. It feels like listening to like a cool new Pink Floyd album or something at times.
Well, that's a perfect lead into the next song, Friend, which feels very, very Pink Floyd. The solo, God, when I heard this live, I just was like, I don't know that I've heard him play guitar like this before. Like, it's his tone, it's his playing and everything, but like the phrasing and that, like, before there was even like a word, you know, sung in the song, I like had tears in my eyes. Just the melody is just so gorgeous.
Yeah, the solo on this is a like a heartbreaker. It's just a heartbreaker of a solo. I was freaking out in my spot at the show. I know I was. I think I like pounding on my friend Kelly's knee. I was like thumping on his knee with my fist. I was so like, holy shit. Because it's different from what Trey does when I see Trey before this, you know?
Just
not what he normally is doing. And the just great blues in that solo.
I was trying to identify like times in Fish's music or shows or whatever, and even in Trey's other stuff, when we've experienced the emotion of sadness. Like even like slower songs and stuff like that, it tends to not be so tangible. Like I am sad about this thing. It's like, you know, it's more like pondering something. You know, you could think about something like Bug, you know. Or even Waste is like, it's a ballad, but it's more of like a love thing. Like the only thing I can think of is like Dark and Down is kind of a Trey song in the same light, but that just turns into more of like a ripping guitar piece. Like throughout this whole thing, like you can feel sadness, and I don't know that exists in Fish. And I think that's, by the way, like, I think that's why a lot of us listen to Fish. I mean, the fact that we do have this joyous music that can make you happy all the time, and you don't have like the ups and downs and stuff, but like to now suddenly have it, it's a little strange. I know. Does that make sense to you guys?
Well, I think you're right. You know, Fish has like Dirt, for example, is, it may be sad to me, but it's not conveying sadness. It just makes me ponder things that make me sad.
Yeah. It's
that
a
makes sense.
That's kind of what I was,
this, he's transmitting that sorrow like a laser beam to your brain.
Yeah.
And Yeah. It's, yeah, I mean, it's great blues.
So Dirt is about death, but it's more like whimsical. And it's like the whole thing is sort of an allegory to a certain extent, whereas here is just like, I am sad.
Yeah. Right. Well, I mean, a lot of that too is just like Tom's influence on Trey's writing, right?
Yeah.
Like when they write songs together, it has a lot more metaphor and a lot more nuance, I think. Not that this isn't good, but it's just so much more raw and straightforward. Like this song particularly is like, this guy was around when a lot of other people weren't, and I'm really sad that he died. You guys know what I'm saying. That's the lyrical kind of thrust of it.
I don't think it's this song. I can't remember which song it is, though. There's a reference in here to Charon giving the coin to the ferryman, but taking the you don't need to drive the ferry and taking someone across. I mean, that, so there's actually some pretty great metaphorical writing, and some of it is more profound than some of his previous work.
Okay, yeah, that's fair. I just mean, like, it's like the song is called Friend, and like the lyrics are like, when I was up, I had a lot of friends. And
it's a blues song.
Yeah. I didn't have a lot of friends. It's like, it's very straightforward in that way.
It's a blues song. Blues songs are straightforward. You know, my dog died. You know, my girl left me. I just ran out of whiskey.
Yeah.
That's my next hit.
I'm sorry that happened.
Yeah, it's almost like a little bit of a callback to like a traditional blues song, like Nobody Knows You When You're Down and Out or something like that. You know?
Absolutely.
And there was like a little bit of a Clapton feel to this solo, I thought. This is the one where like I thought the live show has a much better, like the Trey's soloing is captured much better than the album version. Feels a little bit like a typical kind of Trey solo on a Fish album thing, but like the live version, I feel like, I don't know if it's the tone or what, but it just like, it felt really awesome.
Yeah.
So the album skips over a couple songs, I think after this, but the Sightless Escape, Matt, I was listening to this song earlier and we haven't talked yet about this and I haven't heard a lot of people talk about it, but Fishman being in the mix is obviously a big part of the song, and I'm not sure that it's part of this particular song, but what's your like take on what does Fishman add to this, or how does he kind of complement what's going on in Ghost of the Forest in general?
Yeah, well, it becomes different from either Fish or Tab because you don't have the same rhythm section. You've got a combination. You know, I think that he could have done the same thing, but had it be, you know, Mike and Russ, to get a completely kind of new rhythm section, but stuff that he's familiar with. I think Tony and Fish were probably the right combination for this project. Fishman was playing his ass off in that show. He seemed to be loving what he was doing. He was really emphatic about a lot of his playing. Hearing him play with, it's funny. I feel like Tony Markelis doesn't get enough credit for, like, people will call out the fact that compared to Mike, he's just a very, like, in-the-pocket, straightforward bass player. But, like, that does something. Like, in Tab, it gives Trey the opportunity to just go out and play out front and not have to, like, think about other, you know, melodic components. He doesn't have to think about, like, Mike's going to change the tonal center or anything like that, because Tony's not going to do that. He's just going to stay exactly where Trey tells him to go. So that's nice here, because with the very composed music, but you have the more sort of flourishy rock drumming of Fishman compared to Russ. So I liked it a lot. And I made a comment when we talked about the Mexico shows that I could tell at those shows that Fishman and Trey had been playing together a lot, because they were so locked in Mexico. And you hear a lot of that in these shows and in this material as well.
So I don't know if you guys had anything to say about Sightless Escape, but I want to just say that the next song, Halfway Home, was like when I kind of going back and listening after. First of all, it's like hard for me, and maybe it's not the same for you guys, to like absorb new music and understand it at the same time. So like I had to go back a bunch of times before I started to understand any of this. And if you guys are different and you got it all on the first try, that means you're geniuses and should be awarded some sort of Nobel Peace Prize. But Halfway Home to me was like where I was like, oh shit, this is so fucking smart, because it was like when from the start of that song, it's clear that it's like kind of thinking back, and the way that it, the song is produced is just so, it's like a, it's a dream or a memory about doing really cool shit with a friend and having fun. And I just, I thought that was really cool and very intentional and very different from a lot of the other songs. I feel like it was like, it reminded me of watching like a Netflix show or something where it's like the flashbacks are completely produced differently than like the modern day action, if that makes sense. Like it, it felt
totally,
it's like so intentional in that way. And I thought it was just really brilliant. Trey's talking about his memories hanging out with this guy and all the cool shit they do. And it's just like the organ and like the weird, you know, the weird fills and the weird effects and stuff are like different than the parts where Trey's talking about now, here's what's going to happen next, or here's what's going to happen now that like we're moving on to this next phase. I just think it's like really kind of a smart production and songwriting, I guess, and like the placement of it all.
I quite like this song. And I think it, it sets a nice pace after kind of the high energy Sightless Escape that comes forward in the live show. But it hangs and kind of flows on the album, if I remember correctly, kind of straight into In Long Lines. But whereas live, we have the acoustic If Again.
Yeah.
Yep.
Which is pretty kind of a cute little number. It sounds super familiar.
Yeah.
So somebody tell me what it is. He's lifted part of that out of something else. Or is it... Matt, so Matt, is, you've mentioned this before. Is he like grabbing bits of other songs that he's written, or is it more like thematic similarity, like when you hear a couple different John Williams soundtracks and, you know, he uses kind of this, a similar build or similar swell or crescendo in his, some of his things. They're just, they're not the same, but you can tell it's him.
I think,
yeah, is it that?
I think it's a really, really good metaphor. It's not stuff that has existed anywhere else specifically, but it is probably like a spiritual cousin to some things. I mean, it's the same guy writing the music, right? So he's not,
right.
It's not going to sound drastically different, but at the same time, as we've said, it is very, very different, from that stuff. Halfway home, I dug, I like that kind of 25 or 6-4 kind of groove at the end of it. That gets pretty cool. And then If Again, I really liked, that was one of the pieces from the live thing that I came back to. I liked the combination of Trey's acoustic guitar and Fishman's drumming on that, which was sort of, you know, just like light and added a lot of stuff. And then also having the vocal swells that are in that without actually having any lyrics. And there's some really, really cool chord changes in that. I think of the pieces that were in the live show that didn't make the album, this is one of the stronger ones I really dug.
You know, I want to go to the, something you just said, Matt, before we move on. You mentioned the, you know, it's the same guy writing all of this stuff. And one of the things I was thinking about in the show while I was watching the show, maybe between songs or while listening to some killer guitar solo, was that this, it really is the same guy. This sounds like, you know, the compositional components and the, you know, the more blues or rock components and the writing sound like the guy who was writing, say, you know, these songs that we love in the 80s, but he's how much older now? I mean, it's really, it sounds like what you might expect if you listen to his 80s output and said, now extrapolate.
Yeah.
And I like that.
There were a couple like reminiscent pieces here in Long Lines. I heard like some Rise Come Together just along the same lines of like hearing similar songs or pieces of songs in other songs. I heard like a new Pigtail later, which we can talk about. But did you guys hear like more substantive, like kind of themes from other songs? Like, did this sound like a little bit of that Rise Come Together to you, Matt?
I don't think so. No, I think there's examples that are where you're right. The Pigtail thing, which I can't remember off the top of my head, which song that was. I definitely heard that. Some of the closeness in some of the other pieces to Time Turns Elastic and Petrichor, I definitely heard. In Long Lines is one of the songs that I feel like is very different from anything that we've heard. I would put this in the same bucket as Friend, that it feels darker in a way. And some of the, I think lyrically, man, God, this song is just, it tugs at you. You know, line about, I lit your cigarette, you know, the trembling hands and everything. Yeah. It's like, especially after you read that interview with Trey, where he tells you where they came from that line. It's like, God.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah,
seriously.
I lit your cigarette. Your hand was touching mine. The wild gypsy with trembling hands. Now it's time to join the others, the lost and the loved ones. They're moving around us and waiting and waiting.
I think Ray should have like an actual piano. That was my only take on the music piece here, because his playing is, it's interesting, because I don't know if you guys felt this, but I feel like listening to this, I heard him, like the way he plays the organ in Tab is like so recognizable that when he's like on the any other piece of the piano besides like the actual piano, I know that it's him. But like on the, when he's actually playing the piano, I'm like, wow, this is really cool and doesn't sound like anything that I would expect to come from Ray. But I know that he had this like keyboard up there, and I think they should bring like a concert grand or something in there for him, because it was, whenever he did play the piano, I was like, wow, this is really, really beautiful. I don't know.
Yeah.
I think you should, Matt, can you tell them to get a concert grand for him?
I will get on that. Yeah.
Okay. So the next song in the live, in the live version of this was the Path Above. And again, like just the title of the song. So to me, there's like the songs about what Trey and Chris and whoever are going through and like the trying to figure out what's happening and reminiscing. And then there are songs like this that are a little bit more about like, here's what happens now, or here's what happens next. That's the way I read this song. And Halfway Home was like kind of backward looking and a little bit like, here's what we've been through. And this song is like, here is where we're going. And it's a little bit more breezy. It's a little bit more like, here's the path above. Again, like I heard a little bit of like the final hurrah in here in like the beginning, and then maybe that was just me, but I really like the song and I really like the where it went.
I could hear, like, since I shot down your theory on the last song, I could definitely agree with you being a little bit like the final hurrah. Or even there's one, maybe some of the other Casavox stuff. I could hear that. The thing that I started to think about at this point, between this and If Again, in terms of the narrative arc of like basically processing grief, it seems like the stuff that was on the album, which he wrote first, was definitely more of the early grief, downer, sad kind of stuff. And a lot of the stuff that came later, the newer material, seems like it's more of the like acceptance and, you know, trying to uplift and get past the experience and whatnot. And I think this is one of those examples where it's trying to kind of lift you out of the hole and, you know, get you back to living your life.
I agree with what you guys have to say. I'd just like to say that also that I feel that this could be a Fish song. This one right here. I don't know why this one, but I could hear Fish taking this on, and I'd really like to hear what it would be like with Mike and Paige playing on it, particularly some of the dreamier passages that could be maybe stretched out by Fish. I think I could feel it.
Well, the next song about to run is the song that, according to Scotty B's Twitter conversation, is the song that people most want to hear Fish play, which I don't, it just feels like this feels the most similar to an existing Fish song to me, but maybe that's just me, but it is like I feel like it has a lot of feelings of a current Fish song, but I don't know. I mean, maybe I'm wrong about that. Jonathan, what do you think?
Well, it's worth noting that Scotty B himself also said that he wouldn't want Fish to play it because he feels like it would become a Character Zero song, which for him is not needed.
Yeah.
if you will.
Yeah.
But it's got the tone of a few other songs, but it's great guitar ripping. It does. I mean, it's got this tension both in the lyrics and in the guitar of somebody who is just literally on the cusp of relapsing, running away, burying himself, just escaping, attempting escape. It's a heavy tune. I like it.
Menacing is the word I keep coming back to. And this is another one like Friend that feels like a late era Pink Floyd thing. Like I could even, besides the guitar, I could even hear David Gilmour singing this. I mentioned earlier, the visual component of the show, this song I think had the absolute best visual trick when they had
this
was the pixelated tray up on the screen, rainbow pixelated tray that they were like panning back and forth, and oh my god, if you've seen the show, you know what I'm talking about. If you haven't seen it, then go see the show just for this. It's like, once again, you've never ever at a Fish show seen huge video screens. Even in 2016, they didn't have the band up on the screen. This is the one time in the show when they did this with Trey, and it was like a monster version of Trey, like haunting him from behind himself. It was incredible. Incredible. Yeah,
I tried to take a picture. It did not work, though others have had great success, I think. But see it live. That thing is pretty rad.
Yeah. Yeah. And then once again, you know, the lyrically just like gets inside of you. I keep this, that one line has been rattling around in my head.
Sometimes the ghost is quiet, but the ghost is always there. And it seems no matter how far I go, he goes with me.
What is a city without its music?
The legacy of the New York Philharmonic
is incredible. Nearly two centuries of history. That's a lot of music and a lot of stories.
I was sitting on stage for the very first time thinking, I can't quite believe this is happening.
Join me, Jamie Bernstein, as we explore the history of the New York Philharmonic. It's the NY Phil Story Made in New York, a podcast about a city, its people, and their orchestra. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
So then there's The Green Truth, Jonathan.
It's a gospel tune. It's a gospel tune, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Love it. I'm into it.
Yeah. And then there's Beneath a Sea of Stars, parts one and two, and then Beneath a Sea of Stars, part three is later. When we interviewed Trey last summer for Under the Scales, he said that he was, when we were talking about like how much he loves to write compositions, he mentioned that he was in the middle of one that he wasn't ready to like talk about yet. That was a year ago. And I wonder if this was it, because I don't know what else, unless it's something that hasn't been released yet, but this and the one that comes later, like third part, that's what when I was listening to him, like, oh, I wonder if this is the thing that he was like working on for so long. Do you think it's like something that is like a becoming sort of like a long epic? Can these three parts be put together at some point?
Well, they're together on the album, so yeah. I venture to say that it could be live.
And will they do it live outside of Ghost of the Forest?
I hope so. I dig it. It gets nice and weird.
It's interesting, but it rages too.
Right. It's interesting that he's broken it apart and spread it across the show, whereas it, as a 23-minute whole, it closes out the album.
Yeah, it's intense.
Pretty
on the
serious
album, the whole thing. I like really this a lot. One of the I think it's one of the stronger pieces of material on the whole thing. I mean, it's sort of the centerpiece of the entire thing, this big epic. This, it's funny because I don't know if you guys got this. I thought it was extremely obvious, and then I was talking to somebody else and it made me think that maybe it wasn't quite as on the nose, or maybe I'm just wrong about it. It seemed obvious to me that it was like a description of the afterlife. You know, we're all here together, yeah, and the weather's fine. We're beneath the sea of stars and we're free of time. And just the music, like I sort of kept thinking about, like, you know, being when we were in Mexico a couple months ago, like being just under these stars and with the ocean next to us and beautiful music. And it's like, of course, you're in that moment and you say, man, just like put me here, you know, for forever. And it's like invoking that. But then it gets to that middle noise part where it's almost like you're experiencing death at that point. And I kind of got freaked out listening to it because like I've never been around somebody who, you know, while they were dying, and I'm sure that that's got to be an intense experience. And it seemed like this is the one song where Trey really channeled exactly what he was experiencing, you know, with his friend and into the music. I don't know. Does that sound like crazy talk, or do you guys think I'm onto something?
It's not crazy. I mean, it's speculative. I'll give you that, but but I don't think it's necessarily crazy. He's digging at something. RJ, do you have thoughts on this?
Well, I it reminded me of like more of a funeral than afterlife. Like we're all here together, like celebrating this thing, but also just like with the birds and the sounds, and then like I don't know. I guess the point here is to get into serious depth on it, but to me, it's like, so we're going to all deal with this now together. And then like, actually you go through all this thing where it's like, I actually can't deal with this. That's the way I interpreted like the different parts of this song. It was like trying to reckon with the, like, now we're going to do this. Like the beginning of that song reminded me of like, so now we're at the funeral part of the thing, which is also like a really intense place to be at a concert or listening to an album. But that's like what I heard. And then it's like kind of, you know, dealing with the ups and downs of actually dealing with that. So that was my take. But I think what you said, Matt, might make more sense in that, like, now we're beyond the life, and now we're getting into the afterlife, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know, yeah, man. Shit's serious.
There's definitely a strong belief and regular reference to the existence of an afterlife and the coming together, which, of course, is a great comfort to many. So, yeah. And it's strong in this. But should we talk about the spooky mint siren dream?
Yeah.
Continue on here a little bit.
It's all so spooky. So I don't know what happens. So we either are in the afterlife or at the funeral, and then it just gets more spooky, and then it's like new pigtail and then more jams. I don't even really know what happens after this, but I felt like up to this point, I felt like I understood the story, and then it just, everything got crazy. Matt?
Yeah, this is the one thing that I would say if I had to criticize, you know, the whole thing in one way or another, which I'm having trouble doing, you know, and I feel bad even doing it. But I think that the whole show was a little front loaded with the best material. And I think once we got past Sea of Stars parts one and two, we got into a little bit more of the like slightly generic stuff. Like generic's probably a bad word for it.
That's
like
a bit strong.
It's a bit strong, but like, as I look at this name of song or this list of songs, I'm not immediately like, oh, I know that one. They blend together a little bit in this part of the show. There's a couple of standouts, but you know, like you said, like Stumble Into Flight, it's like, oh yeah, that's the one that sounds like Pigtail. You know, Ruby Waves is like, sounds a little bit more like a Tab song that you'd hear. It's, you know, there's less in this part of the show that stands out as being like super, super unique.
I don't know. Well, let's make sure we don't not credit things like Solis kicking all kinds of ass on Mint Siren Dream.
True. Yeah.
She is just beautiful voice coming through on that one. And yeah, Stumble Into Flight is the next Pigtail, or I don't know. It's groovy. It's awfully, sounds a little familiar. I liked it though.
Yeah.
And Ruby Waves. I really like that too. I kind of, although I've heard it as a Tab song, I also think it could be a good Fish song.
I think that's like the best potential Fish song. And it, again, it's not like totally different from something Fish would play, but the cool like dissonant jam part is what I want to hear. So they should do that.
Yeah.
In the jams, I think. But I guess maybe Matt, maybe you said this, Matt, but I guess the narrative of the story up to this point, the first 12 songs or whatever it was, I thought was like really coherent in terms of like, this is this journey that we're on. But I don't know really much about like the next couple songs in terms of how they fit into it. And maybe that doesn't matter, because that's not the point, is to like connect every single song directly. But I felt like there was like a really coherent 10 or 12 song thing. And then there's some other songs that I thought were great too.
It's funny, as you say that, I'm realizing that most rock operas have this problem. Like, up like the first at least half, like if you think of the typical like double LP rock opera, like the first LP, like you can usually tell the story of what's going on, Tommy sees his father murdered and he goes deaf, dumb and blind. And then he goes,
spoilers,
and he tries to
dude,
be...
come on,
Pink is reliving his life and he winds up behind
You're
the wall.
Tommy
and
Hilfiger?
Then, like...
This is fucked up, dude.
But then like, you usually get to this like side three section where it's like, Rail is going into this place with stuff and like what's actually going on, or like Pink's just like behind his wall pondering shit and like I don't really understand what's going on. But then it like there's like an ending. It's like, oh yeah, there was a trial and the wall comes down, or Tommy,
yeah,
you know, wound up a false prophet, or you know, Rail, you know, I still don't understand what happens at the end of the Lamb, but like
you have to make it to side three to hear Pinball Wizard for example.
Yes. Ooh, yes. So
well
you
played, sir.
So no. I mean, not that musically it's not great.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just story wise, you're usually like, hold on, what's going on at this point? And before you get to the more concrete ending, spoiler alert, the pieces in the machine where you're like, oh, okay, I get it. I get what we've all been through. But like this section, it's like, all right, I think it's thematically on point, but like I don't necessarily understand what this means within the broader context.
So you're saying you should have just stuck with something like a quick one while he's away instead of going with the longer format?
I mean, like the he's away, I mean, like what's so quick about it, you know? I mean, that's everything's got its third quarter problem.
I think so the Ruby Waves is a great jam, and then Shadows Thrown by Fire, Wider, Life Beyond the Dream, In This Bubble, and then Beneath the Sea of Stars Part 3, which I think was, to me, in terms of the live show, the kind of the best part of the live show. It was just such a great jam. And on the album, like you guys said, those three parts are all put together. But that, I thought, was kind of a peak of the show, which was cool, because in the live show, that was the end of the set, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and
which I thought was amazing.
And they kind of replicated the thing from the album of like going back to the title track, and also letting it sort of dissipate into chaos and leaving the stage while it was playing. Really awesome. So that's kind of back to the point, like, you know, you get back to this point like, oh, okay, I get it. Like, here we go, big finish and stuff after, you know, maybe three or four songs that don't seem to have a specific place in the narrative.
I feel bad that we're skipping over some really neat moments here. And Shadows Thrown by Fire, isn't that the one where Solis and Jen started on either side at the lip of the stage with holding the lights, and they have beautiful vocal parts in that. I think it's just them singing on that one, right? Wider, Ray does some really great funky playing that's well worth note. That was a great song. I really enjoyed that song. I think that might have been the one I was dancing with you, RJ.
Oh. Maybe.
Then Life Beyond the Dream is just it's a torch ballad. I liked it. Great guitar. And I think it was just funny that In This Bubble was very kind of bouncy. It was perfectly, you know, like an onomatopoeia thing. It sounded like it was written. But the climax of Beneath the Sea of Stars Part 3, Blue, was terrific and really just left me pumped, and it closes the album beautifully too.
Yeah, for sure. And I like, they're switched here, and I think it worked really well for the show. The running order. But I love on the album how you've got Brief Time right before the whole Sea of Stars sequence. It's nice to have like a little, really, really short song. Just beautiful little piece before you get to, the big thing. And Brief Time, I mean, I guess we can call it out. It seems like it's Trey's Box of Rain, right?
Yeah, it was a beautiful little, very personal song. Although when he's singing it to us in an audience, it can also, you know, he kind of, because he's that quality of a performer, he can make it feel like he's singing about that brief time we're having in the concert, even though it's really, you know, it's about a, you know, he and a friend.
Yeah.
2013 Wingsuit, there was like, you know, cool new Fish songs, but then we had like Chilling Thrilling and Cas Vod Voxt, and now this. Like, what is going on with Trey and this band continuing to make new music? And Matt, does this tell you anything about Fish in general, or is this just like a project that Trey had to like get done because he needed to, and Fish will be like not that affected by it?
Yeah, the Yemblog conversation this past week was what song or songs do you want to see Fish play from this material? And I think my answer is none. I really, mm-hmm. I don't know. Like, I'm not going to get upset and vocal and, you know, pissy.
You're going to walk out.
Yeah. Like, well, I'm not going
to mic aside, storm out of the room.
Exactly. But like,
I agree with you.
I feel like this material should remain on its own. And even like, I would be totally cool if he does this short tour and puts out the album and then just moves on. And it's a moment in time. It's a piece of art that existed and it doesn't get picked apart for, you know, material and other acts. I don't think that'll happen. I think that he'll sort of naturally bifurcate some of the material out to Fish and Tab and see what works. Some of it may not work. So we may hear Fish try some Ghost of the Forest stuff that just never happens. I would think that the likelihood of that happening is increased because Fishman was on the project. But otherwise, I mean, to me, it's really just this separate thing that, the other thing I keep thinking is like beyond just like wanting to kind of contain it and trap it in time, I don't know that the emotional weight of the song would work with the ethos of a Fish show. You know, to get back what I was saying earlier about like Fish really being this unique case, as compared to a lot of musical acts where there's really no dimension of like sadness. Like it's really all some degree of joy or whimsy or something like that. To drop some of these songs into that environment, I wonder if it would either not stick because we're not used to that environment, or if it would somehow kind of like denigrate the material itself and take away some of that weight. I don't know. I mean, those are things that none of us have control over, and we just have to go along for the ride. But that would be my kind of preference, would be to kind of keep them separate. Jonathan, what do you think?
I think it would be a shame to leave some of these songs on the shelf. And I know that Trey intends to bring some of them into other projects. He's stated as much in interviews, I think on the Sirius XM thing.
But he hasn't heard this yet. He hasn't heard this podcast yet.
Yeah, I don't know if that's going to convince him. I just told him like three or four good ones. And we didn't really talk about Pieces in the Machine, which is possibly another one. Because that song kicks ass. I really like that song.
Yeah, it does. It does.
But yeah, I think I expect that he will bring some of these songs over to Fish. Do I expect them to necessarily stick and stay high and go high in the rotation? Not necessarily. I mean, plenty of great songs. Well, okay, maybe not great songs. Plenty of songs have come and gone from Fish. You know, they bring them out one tour, two tours, and they fade away. That could happen here. And not because of the strength of the song, but because of maybe how it fits tonally in the show or what have you. But yeah, we're going to see some of these.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of, we talked about Time Turns Elastic a couple times in reference to like a couple pieces of these songs, but like that song just didn't, and maybe that's just different, but that song just didn't quite work live for Fish, right? I mean, just like energy and size of the room and stuff. And that reminds me that, like, the Anthem where we saw Ghost of the Forest, I think, was probably not quite the ideal place to see them. In that, like, a lot of the other places have been smaller theaters, and I think probably a little bit more intimate, and maybe some of that intimacy was lost in, like, a big place like the Anthem. I don't know if you guys agree with that or not, but it felt like some of the lyrics and, like, the kind of emotional heaviness of it was maybe lost because it was just such a big crowd in a big room.
I was seated, as you know, and
yeah.
I felt like I was connecting, he was connecting pretty well, except every now and then some big dude would rumble over and say, come on, dance. And then you'd leave, and I was back to connecting.
Yeah, that was me. So. Cool. Matt, did you feel like did you feel the intimacy, even though we were in like a big room?
I get your point completely, and I could definitely agree with it in the right context.
Just not in the context of this podcast.
Well, not in the context of it being the Anthem. And I think that's where some bias comes into place, because you guys know how much I love that room. And
I love it too.
I mean, since opening night at that place, I have been waiting to hear Trey's guitar in that room. I've been waiting to hear Gary Brown mix a show in that room. And so it was part of me that was just so excited to finally be, you know, having that happen, that, you know, it was perfect for me. And I would not have put it in a different room. I could see, like, if it was at other bigger venues, I could see it being problematic. Like, I wonder how it's going to come across at the Greek in Berkeley.
Yeah.
I would wonder about that. But once again, I don't know, I haven't been there, but I know it's such an amazing venue that maybe it's going to be the same kind of thing. And as far as DC venues, I can't think of anywhere where they could have had it in DC that would have been better. So, I think that was the right choice.
Yeah, that's fair. And I think, I guess, just back to my point before I took us all on a tangent, I think, like, Time Turns Elastic, you know, was like a really cool thing to hear with an orchestra and in different contexts, and it just didn't work with Phish. And I'm just curious to see what will work with Phish, if anything. I wouldn't mind. I agree with you, Matt. Maybe a couple of these songs become Tab songs, and, you know, with Jen's vocals and the rest of the backing band, and none of it makes it to Phish, that's fine. Phish has plenty of songs. 200 and something, as far as I know, but I don't know. People really want Phish to play these songs, based on what I've heard on the internet. So we'll see what happens. But this is crazy. So is this going to keep happening? Is Trey going to just keep making more stuff, Jonathan?
I think that this kind of goes to your earlier question that you posed to Matt. I think that this is just an example of Trey. He's writing a lot. He's working a lot. And to me, that can only be good for, that can be good for Phish fans. I think that just, I think that energy is going to continue into his work with Phish. I think the summer tour has great potential. Fishman's definitely in good drumming shape right now. So, yeah. And Trey's sounding like fire. So I think it's all good. Even if none of the songs come over and there's no new songs at all, there's great energy in those two guys. Mike's playing well on his tour. Paige is chilling. I guess he sat in with Bobby. I don't know. So he's been chilling in Florida. I think we're set up for a good summer tour from these guys who are just having a great time out there right now on this.
If my best friend died, I would find I would use it as an excuse to do everything from not show up to work, to drink too much, to eat bad food, to not exercise, to lay on the couch and watch TV instead of, you know, attending to things in my life. And here you've got somebody who takes this experience and just beautiful music comes out of him as a result of it. And I'm not saying that it wasn't difficult or anything like that, that it's just like he just woke up one day and this whole thing existed, but like that's on a human level, that's pretty remarkable to me, that Trey is that type of person. And I don't know, you know, he seems like he's kind of back in a bit of a prolific part of his life, to your point, RJ, over the past, you know, kind of few years, but that was the standout thing to me, just that, like, to be able to channel grief into something like this art that is just so absolutely beautiful, is just so impressive to me. And I was so proud of our guy, you know, in the show. And I continue to be.
I've heard a few people say things about the writing. I want to address that one more time and just add that I really enjoy the writing. I think it's very heartfelt and it's powerful. And it's different from what you sometimes have heard from Trey, although not that different from a lot of his more recent output. But to be honest, even if I didn't love the lyrics, with all of this music, Trey could just speak sing the freaking phone book in between the instrumental passages, and I would be pretty okay with that. Like, to be honest. But I do love the lyrics. I really like what he's saying and how he's saying it. And yeah, this is a great thing that we're receiving right here.
Yeah. And it just is so indicative of, like, the, you know, his mantra of just, like, continuing to innovate and continuing to move forward. And hopefully that means that he's going to just keep doing cool shit like this and creating cool projects. And we'll be there to listen and podcast about it, at least.
Got to podcast something.
You know, if they want, you know, if Trey wants us to be, you know, do vocals, background vocals on the next project, I think the three of us could do it together.
We have our own microphones.
We have our own microphones.
Guitarists bring guitars. We'll bring our own microphones.
Well, I'm excited to see them one more time next weekend. But this has been fun to go back to. Matt, is there anything else that you want to say to people before we let them go about what they should listen to or what people should think about when looking back on this music?
We didn't get too much into the album in terms of, like, the production and whatnot. We talked a lot about the material and the writing. It's a great sounding record. A lot of the mix is really great. A lot of really cool effects coming in and out and stuff like that. Which actually, I don't know if you guys caught this live at the show or listening back to the live recording. A lot of those vocal effects were done at the show as well. Little, like, delays and phasers and stuff like that on Trey's vocals to make it sound like the album, which is another one of those things that, like, you know, with the exception of when they put a little thing on Page's voice during No Quarter, like, you don't get, mm-hmm. you just don't get that at Fish shows. So it's, right. That was pretty cool. The album is really neat. Can't wait to get the record. Because the sound of it really draws you in. I would love to see the next Fish record be this ambitious in terms of the sound and the production quality. I don't know if you guys felt the same way, Jonathan, if you're nodding a lot.
I'm a big fan of Fish records in general, but this has the like superior sound to most. It's outstanding. It's probably Trey's best sounding record.
Yeah, and the vocals come through amazingly. I feel like they really captured something special on this album. So everyone should check it out. And yeah, Trey, if you need Jonathan, Matt, and I backing vocals on anything, just let us know. I think we can do a good, you know, we have microphones. Right, Matt?
I think I'd prefer to hear Jen and Celise, but that's just me.
Yeah, that's
they
true.
Can Let's be there to too. I don't think we're trying to take anybody's jobs. No, but, you know,
how do you feel about a 5-piece vocal section?
Yeah, no, they're amazing. The band
I've got
is
some
great.
Low end. You know,
you got some low end. Now, Jen and Celise were amazing. The whole thing was great. I'm glad we got to talk about it. There's a couple more shows, as Matt said at the beginning. If you haven't been able to see them, if you can see them in LA or San Francisco or Berkeley, do it, because it's been really fun to listen to and watch it evolve. All right, so give us a review if you guys haven't yet, guys and girls. iTunes, Apple Podcasts, whatever it's called now.
Unless you want to leave us a bad review, in which case follow your mother's advice and don't say anything at all.
Don't bring bad reviews. So you all know what happens.
You'll hurt Brad's feelings. He may never come back out of the forest.
Oh shit! We didn't talk about it. We didn't even touch on, you know, how Brad would feel about a lot of this material, but I think we can assume that he feels similarly to what we do.
It well, scared he's out, him off to the trees.
He's out crying in the woods, so I think we know.
He's still searching. If he finds the ghost in the forest, he'll let us know. But yeah, thanks everybody for listening and hanging out with us. And yeah, we'll see you guys next time. Keep on rocking.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Welcome to us talking about our podcast for a minute.
What's the name of that podcast?
That's Axe to Grind. And right now you're going to be getting a little taste of it, right down to the shaky microphone and all.
And my name's Bob.
And my name is Patrick, and usually we're joined by Tom.
Tom's the best. Tom has a real grown-up job that requires him to be at work, but we talk about decidedly not-so-grown-up things like...
hardcore music and things that people that like hardcore music tend to like.
So that could be the latest shows, revisiting classic material, talking about the new classics, all the little dorm room nonsense that you imagine from a niche music podcast that you either love, want to love, or hate.
Yeah, imagine all the emotions that you have towards a genre that has impacted your life, and then condense them down to an hour to 2 hours a week.
So triangulate your speakers, think about jumping off the bed, singing along, dancing like an idiot, and listen to Axe to Grind podcast.